My name's Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sober today only through the grace and power of God in the program, in the people, and in the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Dale and the members of the committee for the privilege of being here. This is a great conference this weekend. I'd like to thank Dave for introducing me. And I got to tell you, don't believe anything your sponsor told you about me. It's not true either. And there's a lot of, I'm really happy to be here. There's a lot of people I've seen here that I haven't seen in a long time, a lot of old friends. My dear friend Chuck Roberts, he'd give me $5 if I mentioned his name from the podium. I was supposed to be here last year, and I was, prior to the conference, went over to Hawaii to Maui for 3 weeks, and a friend of mine over there loaned me his Harley Davidson, and I crashed it on the side of Haleakala and ended up in the intensive care ward of the Maui hospital with 7 broken ribs and a broken collarbone and a ruptured spleen on a morphine drip, and which I bet you I had, no exaggeration, 40 or 50 phone calls or visits every day from members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you something, it's pretty hard to appreciate a good morphine drip with all those interruptions. But I was afraid I was going to get out of the hospital and start stealing my friends' TVs or something. I don't know. But I got through it. And it was the first time since 1978 I ever had to take any kind of medication. It scared the heck out of me. It's terrified me. I was afraid of... See, I'm the guy they talk about in the big book, and I was afraid that would set off that deal inside of me, that phenomenon of craving. But I'm here, which is an example that you can go through surgery and all kinds of accidents and all kinds of things and still stay sober. That God is more powerful than anything, that we have unconditional sobriety here. I saw that there was a lot of new people, and I really want to welcome you. I'm real glad you're here. I may even be more glad you're here than you are. If you got to Alcoholics Anonymous the way I did, ending up in AA was the pits. I mean, it was one of the worst things that ever happened to me. I mean, I've woke up in wet pants, and I thought ending up here was worse than that. I mean, you know. But I got to tell you, if you're new, and if you poll everyone in this room that's sober over 3 years, you'll find 2 things in common in every single member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first thing you'll find in common is that none of us really wanted to be here and come here. And the second thing you'll find in common is that every one of us, after we come here and make the connection, we realize that this is absolutely the best thing that has ever happened to us. Absolutely. And, I'm not a recruiter for Alcoholics Anonymous. I kind of think we're overcrowded as it is, but if you're new and you suffer from the same disease that I have, I hope you find something here in AA that I found. I'm the guy that they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the real alcoholic. It says in there that most of us that have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics, and there was something about me that didn't want to be here. There was something about me that kept telling me I was different, I'm special, I'm not quite like you people. And if alcoholism is anything at all, I think the ism is the I separate myself. There's something unique and special about me that's not like you. I'm a different case, I'm unique. And so I remember coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous as a young kid. I started drinking when I was about 12 years old, and by the time I was in probably 20 years old, I was ending up in institutions, and I was introduced to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember sitting there, and I'm 20 years old, and back in those days, there wasn't any young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd look around the room, and there were people there that were 35, 40 years old. I mean, their life was over. I mean, you know, I know why they quit drinking. They had nothing to live for anyway. But I'm 20 years old, and I'm really just a victim of circumstances and a lot of bad luck. And I'm one of those kind of guys that no matter what happens to me, after it happens, I always have a reason, right? I've never done anything out of line that I couldn't explain to you afterwards why I did it, and it would make sense. But one thing peculiar started, I started noticing it, even though I'm not really an alcoholic, every time I drank, I kept ending up where all the alcoholics were at. In hospitals and county jails and Salvation Armies and Hope Rescue Missions and all those places. And I started to get desperate. And I tried to listen in AA thinking, well, maybe there's an answer here. Because I had tried a lot of things. I tried a lot of therapy. I came from a family who sent me to psychiatrists and psychologists as a teenager. Nothing seemed to change anything. I was one of those guys that was under the illusion that if I could uncover maybe some kind of magical moment in my youth when I was a little kid where someone said something that hurt my feelings, I could uncover that and like a helium balloon soar into mental health, you know? And I traipsed around in my childhood in therapy for a number of years and nothing ever changed because nothing ever seemed to change who and what I was. I'm what they talk about in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the alcoholic. That is part and parcel of who and what I am. It's a spiritual malady, and there's, as far back as I can remember, there's always been something not quite right about me. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and as a young kid, and my head doesn't want me to be here. And one thing, back in the early 70s, and I don't know if it's that common out here, but I would go to meetings, and I never heard anyone ever talk about anything except drinking. Now, I'm a real alcoholic, but I also grew up in the late 60s and early 70s, and if you grew up in that time and you ran on the streets that I ran on, we were chemically well-balanced people. I mean, you know, it's not that I'm not a real alcoholic. I'm everything it says in the book, but I did some other stuff. I was one of those kind of guys that if you invited me into your home, I'd ask to use your bathroom, and I'd go through your medicine cabinet, and I'd just take whatever's there. I'd fall down, and other times I'd be up for days. Sometimes I'd get real regular. I probably took enough of those wheels. There's no chance I'll be pregnant this century. But I would point at that, you know, and see, I'm different. I'm not like you. And the funny thing about alcoholism is it doesn't make any difference whether you believe you're an alcoholic, whether you want to be an alcoholic. If you are, you are. And there's a spiritual axiom that people who argue with the truth get sick. And I argued with that, and I argued with it, and I just got sicker and sicker. Here's another thing that really made me crazy, and is that people in AA talked about God a lot. And I had a problem with that. I thought I was the only one. And find out later, there's a whole chapter in the book, We Agnostics, for people like me who have a problem with God. And I was raised in a real religious upbringing. I went to Catholic school, and I went to church a lot, and I was an altar boy and all that stuff. And as a little kid, I tried to be a good Catholic and do all the right stuff, but I could never measure up. Now, looking back, I got to be objective, and I got to tell you that looking back, what was actually said to me by the nuns and priests and what I heard may not be the same thing. And the reason I say that is I am suspect that the receiver might have been a little distorted back there, because there are kids that I went to Catholic school with that are still Catholics. right? And if they heard what I heard, I don't know that they would still be Catholics, right? I think I have the ability to hear about the glass being half empty rather than half full. You know, I'm that kind of a, I seek out the negative. Anyway, I heard about this God who existed to judge me, and he had all these things I'm supposed to learn about, so I have to do. And they're on certain days of the year, and there's these religious holidays and all these rituals, and I have to learn how to do them or else I'm screwed. And then there's all these things that I'm not supposed to do, and I can't do them, and if I do them, I'm in a lot of trouble. I'm going to go to this place called hell, where they burn you and torture you forever and ever, and it's awful. And it never ends, and it's awful. And the nuns told me, they said, even if you're good enough not to do the stuff you're not supposed to do, if you just think about doing it, you're screwed. And I'm one of those kind of guys, you tell me not to think about something, that's all I think about. I'm just one of those kind of guys. I remember as a little kid, in grade school, the nuns would say you gotta be pure of thought, word, and deed. And it's like X-rated movies that start going through my head, you know? And I'm a little kid, and I'm trying to be good, you know, and I don't want to think this stuff, and I can't stop thinking it. And they told me, for guys like me who are always out of line and can't think right, that God shows his mercy and there's hope for people like us, that he's created a place called purgatory. And in purgatory, they burn you and torture you, and it's awful, but it only lasts for a couple hundred million years. So not to offend anybody, but I get to be about 12 or 13 years old, and I discovered masturbation, and I could picture a meter in heaven kicking off the millions of years. And I haven't even done anything yet. I'm just practicing, you know. So I have all those feelings and all those fears and all those prejudices and all those preconceived notions about God. And I had made a choice as a little kid that there must not be a God. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you open that issue again. You open that can of worms for me. And every time I would sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and someone would talk about God, it was like a steel door would slam in my head. I remember one time I was doing time as a guest of a county up in Maine, and from the big state prison, they brought in an AA group that were all trustees to give a talk in there to the inmates in the county, Saginaw County Jail, and there was this one guy, he was a speaker, and I'd been to some AA meetings before, but this guy, I had never seen anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous like this guy. This guy weighed about 250 pounds. He had like tattoos on his arms, and he had long hair and a beard, and he was a biker, and he was in there for murder. I mean, he was like a man's kind of man, you know. I just kind of guy, I would have drank with this guy, you know. And I'm listening to him, and he's telling these great stories. And I didn't do a lot of the things he did, but I would have liked to, you know what I mean? Right? And then he talks about getting sober, and he talks about God, how God's changed his life. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, my God, what have they done to him? You know, this is a great guy. I mean, what have you done to him? You know, I knew guys like that, you know, that I grew up with in the 60s and early 70s that would drink too much wine, or they would do too many drugs, and next thing you know, they're standing on a corner somewhere with a Bible, you know, or they're at an airport with a starter rope coming out the back of their head chanting Hare Krishna, or you know, and you know, it's like you feel sorry for those people, right? They're burnt out, right? And that's, so I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the way I felt about this thing, about God. And when you talk about God, I had a tremendous resistance. And I would sit here, and it seemed to me that everyone in AA just was comfortable with this. They didn't have any problem with it. And once again, I felt separate and like I didn't fit. And I think more than anything is that I'm the kind of guy that when I stop drinking, something happens to me that is unbearable. I stop drinking and a hole starts to open up inside of me that is hard to live with. And I would sit in the middle of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would look at you people, and to me, what I observed is that you were people who stopped drinking and you became whole. You stopped drinking and you became happy. It seemed in the discussion meetings I used to go to back on, in Pennsylvania, it seemed like everyone who spoke was more grateful than the person who spoke before them, right? I mean, it was like, my wife just died, I'm so happy. I mean, I did this, right? And I'm not grateful about anything. I don't feel like you look. I have a discontent and an emptiness inside of me that I can't even put into words, because I can't really tell anyone, because they're going to say, well, Bob, what's wrong? And the problem is that it's nothing's really wrong. It's just that nothing is right. Abstinence from alcohol, to me, I always felt like a fish out of water. I love W.C. Fields. He says, I was sober one time. It was the most boring 45 minutes of my life. And sobriety, to me, always felt like I was doing time. And I sit in the middle of a room full of people who are sober and they're happy, and you make me crazy, because I don't feel like I fit here. And I don't know what you are. I know that you're not drinking, but whatever you are, whatever's wrong with me is can't possibly be the same thing that's wrong with you. And I don't tell anybody this because I don't know how to put it into words. And AA is so crazy. You know, I kept getting sent to AA over and over again, and I don't know what you, it's like you were such, you were so bizarre. First of all, you're happy, you're not drinking. You're grateful for everything. You're so enthusiastic about life. You reminded, and you talk about God, you reminded me of a cross between the Salvation Army and Amway. You know, just right? And here I am. I'm sober, and I'm locked up in here, and I don't fit out here with you. And so I came to the conclusion that whatever's wrong with you can't possibly be wrong with me. That I am different. I am not like you. Yes, I have an alcohol problem. I got the DUIs. I got all that other stuff. I drank myself into homelessness. But when I stop drinking, I don't feel like you guys feel. And if you're new, I really hope you hear this. Is that what I was doing is that I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with untreated alcoholism, comparing what it feels like to have untreated alcoholism to what you look like with the outward manifestation of a program of recovery in your life, and I come up different. I could come up nothing but different. I'm the real alcoholic that Dr. Silkworth talks about. You take alcohol out of my life and I'm restless, irritable, and discontented, unless I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort I'd once found in taking a few drinks. And if I can't find it in taking a few drinks, I'm going to find it in something else. I'm going to find it in her or it or gambling or whatever. I'm going to find it somewhere else. But you take alcohol out of my life and I'm done. I don't fit anywhere. And I don't understand. I know one thing about me at this point in my life. I know that I can't drink. I don't understand why, but I know that every time I pick up a drink, I get in a lot of trouble. And I would hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about this disease that we have, and I thought to myself, that's a cop-out, a disease. And I would hear people mention this, what Silkworth says. Silkworth says that we are people who have an allergy to alcohol. And unlike other allergies, it doesn't manifest itself in hives. When I take a drink, it manifests itself in what Silkworth calls a phenomenon of craving. And I remember hearing people talking about this craving, and I thought to myself, I've never had a craving for drinking. But the peculiar part about a craving is that you don't realize you have it until it's interrupted. Most of us, right, all of us at this very moment have a craving that none of us are conscious of, and it's a craving to breathe. But if you would sit, go out here to the swimming pool and go down to about 3 feet depth and sit there for a couple minutes, you'll realize you have this craving for air, right? And my craving for alcohol was a lot like that. But most of the time, I couldn't see it because it was never interrupted. And I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one time, and this woman was sharing, and the beauty of AA for a guy like me is that no one in Alcoholics Anonymous has ever tried to tell me about me, because you can't. I am so defended. I have such defense mechanisms that if you try to tell me about me, my defense mechanisms come into play and I can't hear you. But in AA, you broadside me, you trick me, you tell me about you, and so my defense mechanisms are down. I'm listening to you talk about yourself, and I go, oh yeah, I'm like that. Whereas if you would have tried to tell me I was like that, I couldn't have heard it. And I'm listening to this woman share her experience, and a light went on, and I remembered something that had happened to me when I was about 18 years old. And when I was 18 years old, in my way of thinking, there was no way I could have been an alcoholic. And I was dating this gal, and I guess she must have thought it was getting pretty serious. She invited me over to her house to meet her family. And we were supposed to have dinner, and it was one of those long all-night deals. I always hated stuff like that, like you're under the microscope, right? And they had a bottle of wine with dinner. And I always drank with a sense of urgency. I don't know why. I think evaporation is some kind of childhood issue with me or something. I don't know. But because I drink real quickly with a sense of urgency, I got two glasses of wine out of that bottle, and I've done two glasses, and they're sipping on their first glass, and I'm sitting there, and I got two glasses of wine in me, and I'm starting to get a little antsy. I don't know about alcoholism, don't know about phenomena of craving, don't know about any of that stuff. And I finally blurted out how nice the wine is. I'd sure like another glass, and they said, well, that's nice, we don't have any more, and they went back to talking about Vietnam and the sports and everything. And I'm sitting there and I'm getting a little crazy. And I don't understand why. And I finally blurted out about how much I like beer. And they said, well, that's nice, but we don't have any beer. And they went back to talking. And I finally said, how about a cocktail? And they said, well, we don't have anything. And they went back to doing their thing. And I'm sitting there and I'm going out of my mind. My head is going faster and faster. I don't understand. I have this feeling like, it's like I caught myself wanting, they're talking, yammering on about all this stuff. I wanted to scream at them to shut up. And then I caught myself and I thought, well, why do I feel that? They're not doing anything to me. They're nice people. You know, I'm going nuts. I excused myself from the table. I went to the bathroom and like an animal, I went through all the cabinets in there and I found a bottle of cough medicine. It was alcohol and codeine and terpene hydrate. I remember sitting down on the edge of the bathtub and like a crazed animal, chugging this bottle of cough medicine so I can think. And I remember finding the cough medicine, and it's like, it's pouring it down, and it's like all of a sudden there's hope. You know, and I sit there on the edge of the tub, and I came up with a story. And I went back out to the dinner table, and I was very gracious. And I told them about this thing I had forgotten about, and I was so sorry, and I hated to have to leave. And they were real nice, and we'll have to do this again. And oh, yes, we will. And I got out to my car, and I drove like a gentleman, about 20 miles an hour, down to the end of the street. And then I drove 90 miles an hour over to a friend of mine's house who had a bar in the basement because I had two glasses of wine. Now, I was the only person at that dinner table that was an alcoholic. If those other people had been alcoholics, we'd all been in that goddamn bathroom looking through those cabins. Right? But there's something, I have this thing, this phenomenon of craving that, and other people don't have it. And I even several years after I was into Alcoholics Anonymous, I secretly believed that everyone who drank got that kind of effect from alcohol. That every drink makes you feel like you want to have another one. But Silkworth says that's not true. He says that we are set apart as a class. We're the only people that ever experienced that. And I thought for a long time that just other people, for some reason, could control it. And we can't. And I really saw what was really going on. When I was about 4 years sober, I was dating this gal who wasn't an alcoholic, and we'd go out to dinner, and she'd order a drink, and I swear to God, it would take her a half hour to drink it. I mean, the ice would be melting, and she'd stir, and she'd take a little sip, and then talk for 10 minutes, right? I mean, that's alcohol abuse, you know? And then she'd do the most bizarre thing I have ever seen. She'd order a second drink, and she'd take a sip or two, or maybe drink half of it, and she'd push it away, and she'd say, "I don't want any more. I'm starting to feel it." It would be easier for me as an alcoholic to have sex and after two strokes say, "I don't want any more of that. I'm starting to feel it," than it would be to do that with alcohol. And I started to realize that I really am different from those people. See, my friend, when she took two drinks of alcohol, she got a feeling like she is losing control. I take two drinks of alcohol, I get a feeling like I'm getting control. It does something for me that it never does for normal people. They'll never understand it. And that I think we as a class are as baffled by the way they drink as they are by the way we drink. They think we think they abuse alcohol and they think we abuse alcohol. I mean, it's just bizarre. Now, all of that would be academic. And in the early 70s, in a treatment center, when they told me I shouldn't drink, I would have said to myself, "You know, you're right. I'm never going to do that again. Except there's another part of this disease, and it's what almost killed me, and I think it's what kills most of us. Is that when I stop drinking, something happens to me that's unbearable. And I'm that fish out of water." And I'll tell you how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. The last time to stay. I was arrested in Pennsylvania for a felony DUI. They say I stole this car. I really borrowed it, but that's beside the point. And I had an accident and a hit and run, and I was sentenced to 2 years in prison. And the judge stayed the commitment. He said, "You don't have to do the 2 years. You have to find a long-term treatment center, and we want you to go in there, and we want you to pay these fines and these court costs and report to this probation officer every week. And at the end of a year, you come back before me, and if your record's clean and everything, we'll reevaluate this, and you may not have to do the 2 years." So it was a good deal for me. The problem is I can't stay sober for a year. And I'm in this treatment center, and it's the only place I could get to take me. It was more like a mission. It was on the north side of Pittsburgh, and they housed about 200 homeless alcoholics. And they would take some people out of prison. It wasn't even a treatment center, really. It was run by a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tried to stay sober there with everything in me. And I had tried before. I know what it feels like to be determined not to ever pick up a drink and just get to a point where I feel after a while that if I don't have a drink or do something to change the way I feel, I'm going to lose my mind. And I eventually took a drink, and the phenomenon of craving kicked in, and I couldn't stop, and I was on the run. And me and another guy started hitchhiking to California. I thought to myself, if I could make it to the West Coast, maybe I could not get caught by the police, and maybe I could survive another winter, because I almost froze to death in the streets of Pittsburgh the winter before I was homeless. I know what it's like to walk all night long, because it's 10 degrees or 15 degrees out and you can't sit down. Because if you sit down, you fall asleep. And if you fall asleep and it's 15 degrees, you're dead. So no matter how sick you are, how tired you are, you walk. You walk all night long. And I thought if I could get to California, I might survive. And I made it as far as Las Vegas. And I was with a bunch of drunks. So we just seemed to be magnets to each other. And I bailed out of their van and checked into a detox. And I don't know what had happened to me. For a long time in sobriety, I couldn't explain it. But something had changed. And maybe when you're done, you're done. And I think what had happened to me is that I knew something about myself I'd never known before. What brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, it seems like looking back now, was not the homelessness, it was not the shame of the things I did to the people who loved me. It was not the wasted jobs and the broken relationships. And all that stuff is really painful and it's part of my story, but that's not what broke my spirit and brought me to that point of surrender. What brought me to that point of surrender is that alcohol did all that to me, and at the very end, it took away its effect. And at the end of my drinking, the worst blow of all is that I sold everything I had, my self-respect, everything else, to keep this party going, and I couldn't even get high right at the end. At the end of my drinking, I'm not the guy that's sitting there passing around a bottle of wine, laughing and telling jokes and part of the crowd. I'm not the guy in some Skid Row bar that's down by the pool table shooting pool and having a good time and talking to the girls. At the end, I'm the guy that's sitting all by himself, drinking, looking out at the people that are having a good time and wondering what's wrong with me. Because I could remember when alcohol did for me what it was doing for them. And I hungered for that with a desperation. Because at one time, see, I'm one who believes with everything in me that alcohol for a number of years was a treatment for the spiritual malady of alcoholism. Alcohol in the early days of my drinking was wonderful. You've probably had these experiences where you walk into a party and you don't know anyone. And you feel like everyone's looking at you. And you want to crawl under a table somewhere. And four or five shots of whiskey, and you're dancing and talking to people, and you're the center of attention, and you fit. In those days, alcohol relieved me of the bondage of self. In those days, alcohol was a treatment for the spiritual malady of alcoholism. At the end of my drinking, alcohol no longer did that. Alcohol left me desolate and stuck. And that's in 1978, I ended up in this detox and the party was over. And I was desperate and I was demoralized and I was ashamed of myself and I felt hopeless. And I didn't think I was going to stay sober. I had tried sobriety many times. And I've tried, you know, the problem with me in trying to not drink is that I come off a run and I'm so beat up and so determined never to pick up a drink again. And I got this big picture in my mind of how awful it is. And what happens in time, the picture is like a smoke signal. It starts to dissipate and get hazier and hazier. And as it's getting hazier and hazier, the emptiness of sobriety is getting sharper and sharper. And the loneliness and isolation of not fitting in this world sober gets bigger, and the memory of the suffering, humiliation of the last run gets smaller and more diminished and more hazy. Until finally it looks like it's a real good idea to pick up a drink because I can't stand this anymore. And in 1978, I'm in this detox hospital, and they're getting ready to discharge me. And I didn't think I felt so hopeless. I really wanted to find the courage to kill myself. And I'm in this hospital, and I know I'm getting out soon. I know I'm going to drink again. And I don't want to drink no more. Because I know the truth now. I know I can, no matter what I drink, no matter what drugs I mix with it, I can no longer get the sense of ease and comfort I'd found as a younger guy, that the party is over. And yet I know something else. I know I can't not drink either. I don't have what it takes to stay away from it. And one of the women who worked in that hospital, ended up being a member of my home group, she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she'd mentioned in passing a prayer in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 63. It's the foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous, our third step prayer. And I don't know why I remembered her mentioning that page, but in a moment of desperation in a hospital room all by myself, I picked up a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and I opened it to page 63. And in the middle of the page is a prayer, and I started to read the prayer, and it didn't make any sense to me because it's thee and thou, and it's all that stuff. But in the middle of the prayer is a line that says, relieve me of the bondage of self. And I read that line, and I threw that book across the room, and I started sobbing. And from the bottom of my heart, I said, God, please help me. And I said that because when I read that line, relieve me of the bondage of self, it was like a gusher. I knew that all of a sudden, I knew the reason I was going to drink again, the reason I was homeless, the reason my family would no longer talk to me, the reason I was all alone and I might get the courage this time to kill myself is because of me. And I don't know how to be anything other than what I am. I tried in therapy. I tried a lot of different times. I can't tell you how many times I've said to myself, okay, I'm going to change my attitude. I'm going to be different. And I'd go out in the world and things are not different because I'm the same. Because everywhere I go, there I am. And I felt so hopeless because I can't get away from me. And I knew I was going to die because I can't get away from me. And I said the first real honest prayer I ever said in my whole life. And that was my moment. That was the beginning of my sobriety. And from that moment to this, I've made a commitment to come here and do what you people do and to buy the whole package of Alcoholics Anonymous. And those of us that stay here are people who do that. The reason I got to that point, I understood later. A guy gave me a book to read when I was sober a while. It was a novel. He actually gave me a whole box full of books because he heard I liked to read. And I'm reading this novel, and there's a story in this novel about these scientists that were doing experiments with laboratory rats. And they found that in the brain of a rat is a thing they called a pleasure center. It's in people, too. It's in a person. It's what allows you to experience the euphoria from drinking. So these scientists took these rats and they put two tiny wire filaments into that part of the rat's brain and they would pass a mild, undetectable electric charge and the rat would get loaded. So they hooked up the juice to a pedal in the rat's cage and the rat would learn he could hit that pedal and get high, so the rat would lay on the goddamn pedal. Right? He don't eat, he don't sleep. I mean, you can parade lady rats in front of him. He says, not now, baby, I'm partying. And he would hit the pedal until he dies. Until he dies. We all understand that. What blew my mind is that after a while, they'd take a rat that's been hitting the pedal for a while that was almost dead, and they would turn the juice off. And this time, the rat would go back and hit the pedal, and nothing would happen. And he'd hit it again, and nothing would happen. And he'd hit it again, and nothing would happen. And he'd finally realize that the party's over. And in every case, the rat would, instead of being able to go back to just being a rat, in every case, he'd curl up in a ball, lay on the floor of the cage to die. Because without the juice, there's nothing to live for. And in 1978, in a moment of desperation, I felt exactly like that rat. I didn't think I was going to get sober. I thought I was done. And I started doing some things that I'd never done before. I got a sponsor. I still have him today. He's sober 33 years. I could talk an hour about the things he's done for me and how the times he's helped me. And I started following his directions. And I'd been around Alcoholics Anonymous for a number of years, but I never did the deal. I would just come to the meetings and nothing would change. And if you're sitting here and you've been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for a number of years and nothing's changed, I want to tell you that this is the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not the program of recovery. And guys like me die in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous if we come here and all we do is become part of the fellowship. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous was never designed and is never suggested as a program of recovery. There's only one thing in Alcoholics Anonymous suggested as a program of recovery. These are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. And in 1978, I fell into the hands of a sponsor who believed in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He believed in service. He believed in buying the whole package. And he started to walk me through this process of AA. And it started to change my life. My sponsor got on this kick when I was new. He just had me read this one part of the book over and over and over, from page 60 to 63. And I know that some of you have read it. It's about the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the scenery, the ballet, right? Selfishness, self-centeredness. And I'd start reading that, and I would go to my group, and I could look around, and I could see how there were people in my group that were doing that. Became real clear to me there were some people in there that were running the show, and now I knew why my sponsor wanted me to read that, so I could enlighten them. And I'll tell you, it's a tough, lonely business when you have that awareness of how people really should be and what they're doing and everything, and that sense of urgency to tell them. And there's, interestingly enough, there's a line in the 12 by 12 that says that we will always see our defects of character in others before we can see them in ourselves. And that's what was going on. And then there came a day, a glorious day in my sobriety. I was sober a little while, and I was secretarying this meeting, and I had this new guy that I was brand new, I was working with, and I told him to meet me at the meeting early, and I'm going to stop and get some styrofoam cups and some, I think some sugar or something for the meeting, before the meeting, and I get to the grocery store, and I've had a tough day. I've had one of those kind of days. I'm working as a cashier in a store, and the customers are like annoying me, you know, they're just bothering me all day long, and I'm the only one that's doing any work, you know, and it's just, it's real frustrating. I get to the grocery store, I get my stuff, I get the 9 items or less line, there's some woman there with 12 items, you know, and I'm, in my mind, I'm committing murder, you know. I get in traffic, and I'm afraid I'm going to be late to meet my newcomer, and I'm driving like a maniac, and there's some woman that's going about 3 miles an hour below the speed limit, and I want to run her off the road. And I'm like a steam boiler that's just boiling, building up steam, right? I get to the meeting, and I sit my newcomer down where I know he's going to hear the message, and I wait till the right people come in, and I get them to chair the meeting, you know, and they start the meeting, and they ask for a topic, and there's some guy in there, it's a drug addict, and he starts talking about drugs, and then some other guy cuts him off and starts yelling at him, you can't say that here. And some guy jumps in to defend him, and it's like a war, and I'm sitting there, ready to explode. My newcomer is not hearing what he's supposed to hear. You guys are ruining the whole deal, right? I realize that I'm probably the only one in Alcoholics Anonymous that cares about any of this stuff. Right? I'm about ready to quit AA. I throw the literature into the bag after the meeting, and I storm out of there, and I go home, and I'm done with you. I'm done with Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm done with the whole deal. And I call my sponsor, because that's what I'm trained to do. My sponsor says, read page 60 through 63 of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. There I am, right? It's not Joe, and it's not Bill, and it's not Mary, it's me. And I started to get a glimmer of the exact nature of my problem. Big Book says that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And I have never run across a problem since I've been sober that wasn't the deal. There's a part of me, it says in there, the first we must quit playing God, it didn't work. There's a part of me that just loves to play God, yet I couldn't see that. I remember going to my sponsor in early sobriety with lists of, I would sit in meetings and I would notice that this guy's cheating on his wife, and this guy's got, he's got that big car, he thinks he's a big shot, and this gal, she just keeps, all she's doing is trolling in the meetings, and this guy's a born again, and this, right? And I have these lists of everybody that's out of line, and then I'd have lists of people that are out of line at work. This guy's stealing, right? And I go to my sponsor, and he'd say the same thing. He says, you got to quit playing God. I think, playing God? I'm reporting accurate information here, right? I'm not playing God. What are you talking about, right? And I can't see it. I'm sitting on a throne in judgment, as if it's my job to mind everybody else's business. And I'm gossiping about people, and I'm doing all that stuff, and I'm playing God. Because that's what self-obsessed people do. You take alcohol out of my life and I become so internally focused that I grab onto all these things to defend myself against life. And one of the things that I do is that I sit in judgment because I feel so less than that I try to pull everybody else down around me. It's like the dumbwaiter effect, right? Because I'm not enough, and if I can make you out to be screwed up, I won't be so bad. And the problem with that is all it ever did was make me feel more separate. And I started, I got together my sponsor and I got down on my knees and I did a third step. And I said the third step prayer. And I got to tell you, honestly, when I did it, I don't know that I understood exactly the words that I was saying. And I come to believe that I think God took what I said more serious than I did. Because I said, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou will. And the next 6 months of my life was everything got turned upside down. I lost my job. A relationship I was in broke up. My roommate moved out. I couldn't afford the apartment. I thought I was going to lose I was going to be homeless. I was working in a place. I thought I'm going to do this the rest of my life. Not only did I lose the job, I couldn't get another job in that field. And God was doing with me and building with me. And I was like an abandoned building and he had to tear a lot of things out. And during that period, I'd sit in meetings or I'd sit watching TV. And all of a sudden, it's like I would just start crying, you know? And I don't know where it's coming from. And I just remember these things from when I was a little kid or from just the things I did when I was drinking and the shame. And it just started coming out of me. And I started doing a fourth step. And by this time... I am sober just long enough to have enough self-esteem to be dangerous, right? And I go to my sponsor, I say, I want to do a four-step. And I said, what should I do? He says, it's in the book. He gives me the page numbers. And I go to the book and I look at the book and I'm reading it, but I don't understand what it says. I don't know who Mrs. Jones is. I don't know if it's Mr. Brown, right? I don't get it. I don't get what it's saying here. So I made the mistake that a lot of us make. I went to a meeting and I listened to people talk about the fourth step and tried to figure out how to work it based on what they were saying in the meeting. That's kind of like having something wrong with your car and going to a restaurant where mechanics hang out and over listen to their conversation and then go try to fix your car, right? And I had too much ego to go to my sponsor or another old timer in AA and say, would you please sit down with me and show me what to do? So instead, I just wrote out my whole life story. I wrote out 40 pages of gruel of all this stuff I'm ashamed of and all these secrets. And it wasn't all bad. I got together with my sponsor and I shared this stuff with him. And I got some things off my chest that I'd never told another human being. And that's not all bad. But everything that it talks about in Alcoholics Anonymous after that point in the book didn't happen to me. And I found myself still very anxious and full of fear and restless, and I kept finding myself not fitting and judging people in AA and judging my way right out of the meetings and doing all that stuff. And I kept changing jobs because I'd go to work somewhere and I'd be fine for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and then I'd start realizing how they're taking advantage of me there, you know? And I'm not getting paid enough, and I'd quit and go somewhere else. I'd quit and go somewhere else. And in my fifth year of sobriety, I went back and I was finally able to do a four-step the way it is in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went through the steps again. And this time I did them precisely the way it's outlined in AA. And it changed my life. And I started to see what really is the problem. It's not all the bad stuff I did. It's my thinking that's always been out of line. I had built cases against people all my life, and I did it even well into sobriety about how they're so screwed up and I'm so great. And it was my thinking that was wrong. The book says this was our course. We had to see how the person who had harmed us was perhaps like us, spiritually sick. And for the first time in my life, I had to do something that a self-obsessed guy like me, who has a vested interest by his ego in resenting people, never did. And that's to put myself in your shoes and to see if I was suffering from the same fears and insecurities and frustrations that you were suffering from. If I grew up like you grew up, if I was in your shoes, how I could have done the exact same thing to someone else that you had done to me. And you know what I found? In most cases, I'd have been worse. In most cases, I would have been worse. And I started a process of diminishing the separation between me and other people, and then taking the responsibility for everything I've ever done wrong. That I was the, all, you know, the cruel, if you're new, the cruel thing about step 4 and 5 is that you list all these people that have hurt you, and you come out the other end and you owe them an amends. I mean, it's just, right? It's just baffling. But in every case I did. Because I, like it says in the book, I had made a decision based on self, which later placed me in that position to be hurt. And I was the guy who did it based on my own neediness and my own need for attention and my own self-centered greed and lust and everything else. I took actions regardless of the welfare of other people because I never stopped to consider anybody except me. Self-centered people don't. My earliest memories, even of childhood, are really only one thing I remember, and that's me. Right? I can't tell you much about how my sister felt about anything or what problems she struggled with as a kid. I can't tell you about the problems my parents struggled with. I can tell you all about me. I can tell you lots about me. That's why I love therapy. I'll pay anyone. Just listen to me for a while. I mean, you know. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, and through the amends process and working with newcomers, Alcoholics Anonymous has started to change my perception of the world. I belong to a group who is very, very entrenched in service. We do 9 or 10 hospital and institution meetings every week, and I've gotten the privilege the last, ever since I've been sober, but I've been doing these 2 Skid Row detox meetings every week for the last several years. And it is one of the greatest blessings that have ever been given me. And I got to tell you, when they asked me to do these 2 meetings, I balked. I remember this is exactly what I thought. I was doing I've been doing a lot of service. I've always done a lot of service. And they asked me to do these 2 meetings. I thought to myself, why me? I've done enough stuff in AA. Why doesn't someone else do something around here? Now, I'm being offered the greatest gift I've probably have received since I've been sober, and I want to throw it away. And I've gone to those, I go to those meetings twice a week, and I see something that most of you will never see in the mainstream meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I see the guys with 15 and 20 and 25 years that drink again that never make it back to mainstream AA. But they make it into a Skid Row detox where they go back out to the streets to die again, and they can't come back here because they got so much pride. I see the guys that had great programs of recovery, that had sponsored a lot of people, that talked from podiums in AA around the country, and I see them drink again. And my friend Billy says something that I love. He says, if I have the same disease that you have, what can happen to you can happen to me. And I'm not immune from that. You know, there's a line in the book. It says that we are at times unable to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a month or a week ago, we are without defense against the first drink. And I can't sit in my home group with people that are sober 30 and 20 and 15 years and we're all doing pretty good, and there's a couple newcomers there that are sober a month and a half and they're getting it and we're all real good, and bring into my consciousness with sufficient force what it's really like to come off a drunk. But I show up down there and it smacks me in the face twice a week, every week. And I've gone into those meetings sometimes frustrated with life and scared and had my priorities all out of whack, and walked out and felt so lucky to be alive and so lucky to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. What a tremendous gift this is, because I listen to these guys and I hear me. I hear the guys that judge their way right out of AA. The first time I ever had an experience with that, there was a guy when I was brand new named John, and John was an attorney who has been disbarred through his drinking, and he was sober several years and he got his law practice back. And he used to come to the detox I was in and then later to the halfway house and give myself and a couple other new guys rides to meetings. And John helped me a lot when I was new. And after about a year, I didn't see John anymore. And I didn't see him for a couple years, several years. And I ran into him in a store one day. I was so glad. He lit me up. So glad to see him. I said, John, how you doing? And he says, oh, everything's great. My law practice is going great. Me and my wife are getting along. I said, well, how come you know, I don't see you at any meetings? He says, Bob, I don't go to those meetings anymore. I've outgrown Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, my wife and I have joined this church, and we run a couples group. We help other couples with their marriage problems. I'm a certified counselor in that now, my law practice is going great, and we only hang around with people of our that believe the same way we believe. He says, you should realize by now, Bob, that people in AA just say the same stuff over and over again. They just keep themselves sick. I was devastated. Because here's a guy who really helped me. I went to my sponsor and I told him about it. I said, what's going on? He says, wait. My home group, for up until the time it closed, used to take a meeting Monday nights into a place called, it was a care unit. It's a detox treatment center in Las Vegas. And several years later, I'm sitting in this meeting. And at the beginning of the meeting, they ask everybody to go around, give their first name, introduce themselves. And go around, I'm watching this guy, if you've ever seen a guy in a meeting that you know, but you don't know where you know him from. And they come around, and this guy says, I'm John, I'm an alcoholic. And he had slit his wrist several times upward in a serious attempt to kill himself. He'd lost his law practice, he lost his wife. He'd been living on Skid Row for the last year. And John judged himself right out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it scared me because it was at a time in my sobriety where I was starting to do that. I was starting to go to meetings, and I would list, people would share, and I'd go, oh, is she going to talk about that relationship again? You know? And, oh, is he going to talk about that? He's going to tell us about his new car again, you know, or this, you know? And I started judging myself. After a while, there's nobody I'm listening to except my head. And I think some of us leave Alcoholics Anonymous inside ourselves before we actually physically ever leave. And I know that that can happen to me. And I ask God on a regular basis, please don't ever let me think that I've outgrown Alcoholics Anonymous. The bad part about leaving AA is we always leave it in a worse position than we found it. And by the time I found AA, I can't imagine anything would be worse than that. The last 6 months of my life has been, about 9 months has been real tough. Through the 12 steps of AA, I got to make amends to my family, and I got real close with them. And my dad died years ago, and it was because of AA, it was a nice experience. And last year, my mom came down with terminal cancer and emphysema, and she started dying, and it was a hard deal to go through. I spent every day, I'd go over to her house and I'd watch her deteriorate slowly. I watched her get down to 50 pounds, and I had to put my sister and I had to put diapers on her. We'd have to come over and change the diapers. And this was a woman who had such dignity in her life. She wasn't an alcoholic. She was just a very refined, graceful woman. And I watched her deteriorate. And my sponsor told me, he said, even though you think you've made all your amends to your mom, he said, things are going to come up. When you're sitting there holding her hand, things are going to come up. And he says, I want you to say to her anything that comes up. And he was right. Stuff started coming up that I never would have thought of. One day I'm sitting there right before she died, and I'm holding her hand, and I started crying, and I told her, I said, Mom, I want to tell you how sorry I am that I can't possibly take care of you now that you're sick as well as you took care of me when I was a little kid. And she just patted my hand and she said, but I'm your mom. And I sat with her for 23 hours while she took her last breaths, and I watched the tenacity of human life. and it was a tough thing to watch. And I had such mixed feelings. I sat with my sponsor. I went to a detox meeting right as soon as, like 4 hours after she died. I was at detox doing a meeting, and I talked to my sponsor right after that, and I told him all these mixed feelings I had. I felt a relief, actually, that she was dead, and yet I missed her so desperately. I remember the day, a couple days later, I'm standing in this chicken restaurant ordering chicken, and the woman asked me what side dishes I want, and I just started sobbing, you know, and I was embarrassed, and I think she must have felt like maybe they didn't have the sides I was looking for or something. I don't know what she thought, but I was just sobbing in this restaurant. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a guy, and I never thought about it. I didn't feel that. I mean, I felt a little embarrassed, but not really. I just did it. Just did it, you know. Because I'm not. I don't. And when I came to AA, I couldn't cry. You could beat me half to death, and you wouldn't get tears out of me. And I still miss my mom a lot. And I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous in the eighth and ninth step that I was part of her life. When I got sober, I never imagined that she would be in my life again. And I knew the truth. The truth is I didn't deserve her in my life. I had robbed her and humiliated her and my dad to such a degree that I didn't deserve them, good people like that in my life. And I didn't think I was entitled to anything. And my sponsor was relentless with step 9. He made me pay back every dime that I owed them. And even after they told me I didn't have to pay them back, he made me pay them back anyway. He said, I don't care what they say, you still owe them. And it was, I think through the ninth step, I got to buy back my self-respect a nickel and a dime at a time. And it's one of the greatest things I've ever done. I'm one who believes that if I don't do that, then no matter how sober I think I am, if I'm not even with God's kids, I'm just not even. And I've watched people in sobriety sober a lot of years that have never cleaned up the wreckage of their past, and I've watched them systematically destroy themselves in sobriety over and over and over and over again. Because I don't think it's possible to fool the God inside of me. That if I know I'm not square, I'm not square. And Alcoholics Anonymous has turned me into a receiver of God's grace. In 1971, when I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, God's grace waited for me. It was my divine right. The problem was never with God and His grace. The problem is that I was a damaged receiver. And through the 12 steps of AA and a set of actions that made no sense to me, you people have taught me how to not only repair the receiver but maintain it so I can be open to God's gifts today. And I'm out here with a guy that I sponsor. He's from this part of the country. And I thought, how unusual that I was supposed to be out here last year, and right after that, he got sober. And it just so happened he needed to come out here and make some amends when I'm coming out here for this conference. And we flew into Kansas City, and we're driving cross country, and it's like, oh yeah, I robbed that place. And this is where I did that. It was like a fifth step with pictures, you know? And I love watching people go through the steps. It's the highlight of I love to watch the change in them. It's an amazing thing to watch. And if you're new and you're sitting here and you're uncomfortable and maybe you've been around Alcoholics Anonymous before, maybe you've been in and out, I encourage you to find and grab on to someone who's sober a long time that is entrenched in this book called Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the program of recovery. And I hope that you get as desperately into AA as I did, and you'll find the most incredible thing you've ever found. You'll find a change in you that after a couple years, you'll sit in a meeting and you'll look around and you'll realize something you won't be able to believe. You'll realize that there's not another person on the face of the earth that you would rather be than you. Thanks.